You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 12th of December 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up, we hear about the factors that have shaped Theresa May's battle to hang on as leader of the United Kingdom and to shape its future in Europe. Plus, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has had a much easier go of late, but is facing down what's promising to be a nasty upcoming re-election campaign. We'll look ahead to Canada 2019. We'll also get the latest on Chinese-Canadian relations and flip through the latest Asian newspapers. And we hear about a unique club for the top communications officials in EU institutions and European governments. Plus, we flip through the latest edition of our winter weekly newspaper with Monocle's business editor. All that ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. Welcome to the Monocle Daily with me, Tom Edwards. We start here in London. Theresa May has had a difficult few weeks, nobody would argue with that. But of the multitude of challenges facing the beleaguered British Prime Minister, many might also argue that the major ones have been, at least partly, of her own making, from her doggedly hard-line stance on Brexit to her inability to unite her own party, let alone the rest of the UK, around her vision for how the nation should exit the European Union. All of those factors, and more, came to a head today, with the Prime Minister facing a vote of no confidence from her own party. And we're joined now by Lance Price, who was Tony Blair's Director of Communications when he was Prime Minister. Lance, thanks for being with us. Look, it's been another incredible 24 hours in Westminster and for the UK, I guess. Bring us up to date with your take of how things have been unfolding.
Well, this was one of those occasions, and there have been quite a few of those in recent weeks and months in British politics, where there was really no good outcome. There's just the least bad outcome. But, of course, for Theresa May, that's slightly different. And this was a very good outcome for Theresa May because she's won her vote. And that means that she can't be challenged again for another 12 months. She's secure in the job of Prime Minister. She can go and try to get a better deal from the other 27 European countries. If she succeeds, or even if she fails in that, she can't be removed as Prime Minister other than by a general election. So she will sleep very comfortably in her bed tonight. And it's also the least bad option, I think, for the country and for the rest of us, because had there been a leadership election, all the candidates in that leadership election would have had to tilt towards the right, towards the far Brexit position within the Conservative Party in order to win that election. And the chances are we would have ended up with a Prime Minister who was less pragmatic and more wedded to Brexit and all the damage that that could do than Theresa May.
Now, Lance, obviously, receiving a leadership challenge, even if you survive it, is not great in terms of your job security going forwards. Though, of course, as you say, she can't be challenged for 12 months. And obviously, the scale of a success is also relevant here. But I just wonder, in terms of looking forwards, and, you know, in many ways, what happens next is still as clear as mud. Do we have some educated guesses as to what the next steps in this process look like? What could be the things that unfold in the days, if not weeks ahead?
Well, I think that Theresa May actually, I mean, this was a sort of back me or sack me moment. Although she didn't bring on the leadership challenge, I suspect that during the day she was not disappointed that it was happening because it settles the issue for 12 months. So she can now continue her efforts to try to improve on the deal, or at least get clarifications of the deal that will satisfy members of her own party and Parliament, in a much stronger and more confident position. Now, that doesn't make those negotiations any easier. It doesn't mean that the other EU leaders are going to be more enthusiastic about making any significant changes to the deal that's already been agreed. We have to remember, it's already been signed and sealed. It's just whether it can be delivered. So it doesn't make that aspect of what goes forward any easier. But what it has done, I think, and this is really important, it has pretty well put the extreme Brexiteers in their box because they have nowhere else to go. And it means that if Mrs. May wants to change position, and she's changed position in the past, so she can do it again, if she wants to change position to walk closer to the Labour policy and closer towards an even tighter relationship with the European Union going forward, then she has the freedom of manoeuvre to do that. And that, I think, is very significant.
Lance Price, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Now, Canada's government has passed legislation this week aimed at curbing potential foreign interference in the nation's upcoming elections. In 2019, the new rules also look to constrain the influence of big money in the electoral system. To tell us about how the contest is shaping up, we're joined by Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief, currently in London. Lucky us, it's Thomas Lewis. Here
lucky,
he is.
Lucky you. Hello there, Mr. Edwards.
Good evening, Thomas. It's nice to have you with us here in the studios.
It's lovely to be here. I'm glad they let me through the into the country.
Exactly. We used to sit around this table, didn't we? You
we
and
did.
I, when you
those
were stationed
golden,
in the
those
UK.
Golden days.
Anyway, let's talk about your new neck of the woods. Oh, well, you've been there for a while now. And, you know, elections forthcoming in 2019, lots of interesting narratives. And I think one of the things as an outsider looking in is the difference, a little bit like France, of Trudeau's, how he's viewed overseas as the problems he faces at home, which we'll come to. What are the big headlines that people need to kind of be thinking about as we look ahead to October?
Well, I think this, you know, Canadian elections, I suppose, are slightly more like, say, British general elections, where it's a very contained campaigning period, unlike in the US, where the race for 2020 pretty much is underway already. So I think in that score, you know, elections kind of really sort of gain sort of momentum and an energy in the public psyche, at least, kind of very much closer to election day itself. I think this year might be a little bit different, even if it's just the sort of tone of the discourse, really. As you say, Justin Trudeau, who is elected by a surprise sort of majority, actually, back in 2015, all the polling up until that point showed that his party, which is the traditional party of government in Canada, the Liberal Party, had been losing seats pretty steadily for about 10 years. And it was predicted that they would do the same again, and that whether this big shift in, you know, the makeup politically of Canada was going to be sort of sealed, if you like, with that election. Well, with the surprise majority that he won, it sort of, you know, made people question that again. I think what we're looking at this time around is that Justin Trudeau is undoubtedly the most potent soft power asset, if you like, as well as being Prime Minister, that Canada has at the moment. You feel as though the conversation internationally about Canada has changed almost entirely because of him in the premiership. That conversation is not the same at home in Canada. He is facing rising choruses of criticism from a variety of quarters, actually, be it from the centre of oil and gas production in Alberta, which is having an exceptionally turbulent time at the moment, be it from those in Quebec, for example, where anti-immigration sentiment is highest, be it from those where traditional jobs are fading away and there is a push to, say, for example, implement new technologies like artificial intelligence, which is really Canada is finding itself at the centre of. So incredibly exciting times in various quarters. But I think what Justin Trudeau has found so far, or in recent times at least, is that he's had a lot of triumphs. You know, the immigration policies that he has implemented are, you know, very noble ones that other governments that are closing their doors, I think, should really sort of look to. Also, the renegotiation of the NAFTA treaty with the United States, that was undoubtedly a success for Justin Trudeau and his government. At home, though, the message isn't chiming in the same way. So I think what the next year, the next few months will really, you know, the challenge will be for him is how that message sort of gets through, because I think his tone is changing. We're seeing that already. But it's whether that change will be effective or whether he's sort of lost the hearts and minds of lots of the people who voted from last time.
Now, Tom, in the introduction, I mentioned these planned changes in the legislation governing things like fears of foreign interference and regulating big money and how it can affect the electoral process. And I guess one could look at that and say, you know, here is yet another manifestation of the dissatisfaction that a lot of people in the country have at processes, systems, feeling let down by the political classes or the political system. Has that long been something, you know, when you're having conversations with people about the place in Toronto or further afield within Canada, you know, people said, this is a system that's ripe for an overhaul, regardless of what they think about Trudeau and his dealings domestically or internationally. Has there been a feeling that the system of electoral governance needed a bit of a, a bit of a sort of a boost?
I think my sense is, Tom, is that actually the experience of the United States in 2016 and the ongoing investigations into that have really sharpened that kind of debate. Because I think kind of, you know, say in the United Kingdom, you know, which obviously Canada gets a lot of its electoral systems and parliamentary structure from, you know, are people talking in the pubs of London about sort of, you know, electoral reform? Well, I would probably say no, they aren't. And I think that's probably the same in the US. I think when you look at when Trudeau won, he did make a proportional representation a big kind of thing. And he stepped back from that, which has raised the ire of a lot of people and is one of the salvos, I think, within this kind of slightly sliding popularity that he's finding himself in. It's kind of another promise broken. But I think, you know, given that he ran on a lot of bold and ambitious platforms, be it, you know, opening the doors to refugees from the Syrian war, you know, bringing in a million, I think, nearly a million immigrants to Canada by 2020, legalizing marijuana use, you know, all of these things. And then for the reform in the electoral process to have sort of slipped, I think has disappointed a lot of people. I asked Justin Trudeau about kind of interference and his fears of that at a press conference earlier this year. And his response actually got a pretty sharp one from the Russian embassy in Ottawa. But I think, you know, that kind of his approach and his sort of, you know, desire, it seems, to sort of be pretty strong about this isn't just for show. I think he has put into place a lot of measures that, you know, would look at, say, the role technology plays and how people make up their political decisions and how those things are sort of manipulated to sort of a negative. And I think, you know, it's a very sort of unknown sort of entity, really, for Canada, because it's a very different political landscape to the United States. But I think undoubtedly there are attempts underway already to influence and to sort of meddle and to see how far, you know, that kind of thing can be pushed and, you know, sort of Canada's next, if you like. So I think, you know, Trudeau is taking a sensible approach and sort of trying to stave that off. Again, in the hearts and minds of people, whether that'll be enough or whether that'll do anything, we'll have to wait and see.
Let's just talk briefly, Thomas, finally, about then Trudeau's approach, because we've seen other leaders, as we mentioned at the top, who are sort of embattled almost at home, but can still gain quite a lot of political capital through, you know, playing the statesman overseas. Does Trudeau have to be slightly cautious about how much time he spends doing his global statesman role? Because back home, that may be viewed, certainly by those people with a sort of an axe to grind, you know, as a negative. You're not addressing the problems at home. You're, you know, swanning around, glad-handing everybody. Or do you think we might see a shift in his focus and see him back on the home front, trying to deliver on some of those promises you mentioned earlier?
We've already seen a shift in that focus. So I think, you know, during the summer this year, he did a big sort of national tour of sort of stump speeches and that kind of thing. And I suppose quite famously, he was accosted by one protester in Quebec in a rural town. There was a summer event happening there where she was raising concerns about immigration to Quebec. And it got very fiery and he was very visibly kind of, you know, wound up by this. And he famously said, "Madam, your racism has no place in Canada today." And that caused a huge debate across the country. A, well, the Prime Minister's just called a voter a racist. B, actually, he's calling out someone who is kind of expressing bigoted views, who isn't actually listening to why, you know, immigration might be a good thing or why it matters or why it's such a sort of an ideological sort of pillar, if you like, in kind of what Canada has been for quite some time. So he is focusing on the domestic, I think. He had a very ill-fated official visit to India in February, which is still regarded domestically as a huge, huge embarrassment. So you will see him on the local front. You'll see him travelling the length and breadth of the country. And I think what he'll be doing in those visits is going to places that, for example, will benefit from the new NAFTA treaty between the US and Mexico, so to manufacturing plants. There was a big news recently about GM closing a huge production facility in Ontario. So he'll be going and showing that he is listening, and he is actually very good at sort of doing these one-on-one things. And I think that will be the focus in the year to come before the election.
Thomas, great to hear from you as ever. That was our Thomas Lewis here in London. You're listening to the Monocle Daily.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're listening to The Daily here on Monocle 24. We look now to China, where a Canadian former diplomat has been detained. Michael Kovrig, who works for NGO Crisis Group, was seized on Monday. To tell us more, we have Monocle's James Chambers here in the studio in London, away from his usual Hong Kong outpost. James, good to see you, as always. Bring us up to speed with this one and tell us a bit about, I guess, the context, some of the background behind this latest development.
So we're not exactly 100% sure of all the details, but it looks like this former Canadian diplomat was passing through Beijing on Monday when he got arrested by the Beijing Bureau of the State Security Council. So this is these are the guys who deal with counterintelligence and espionage. As you mentioned, he is a former diplomat, and he's currently on a leave of absence working for International Crisis Group, which is an NGO that promotes peace and conflict resolution. So at the moment, there's no suggestion that he was in China for professional reasons. Some of his employer and some of the Canadians are saying it was for personal reasons. And China hasn't confirmed why they even picked him up. The foreign minister has not confirmed it, but he has said that this NGO is not registered in China. So if they are carrying out any activities in China, it would be in breach of China's foreign NGO laws. So that's kind of alluding to some of the reasons why they may have picked him up. But of course, everyone's suggesting that this is a retaliatory move that follows on from the arrest of the Huawei CFO.
Exactly. And this is, of course, is the kind of the interesting narrative, which is, well, spoken and unspoken, depending on who you're talking to. Because China had warned of the gravity of the consequences after this arrest of this Huawei executive. This was to do with alleged breaches of sanctions against Iran and all the rest of it. We should be used, though, shouldn't we, to that sort of response from China, to that original incident, this idea of threats, idle or otherwise. How often do they seem to then manifest themselves in these sorts of very direct gestures, if indeed that's what this turns out to be?
There is a bit of precedent. There was a dispute between Canada and China back in 2014. I think the Canadians accused Beijing of hacking into some of their databases. And the response in China was to round up these two Canadian Christian Aid workers who ran a little shop in Beijing, detain them. And one of the guys ended up in detention for 2 years before he got charged and deported. So it's not like they haven't done this before. But it's interesting to read some of the commentary by Canada's ambassador to China during the time that this guy Michael Kovrig was a diplomat. So the ambassador, this guy called Guy St. Jacks, he was the ambassador from 2012 to 2016. And he's an old China hand. He was in China for 13 years. So, you know, if anyone knows the Chinese, you know, he does. And he said he is surprised by this response. He expected something from the Chinese, you know, cancelling state visits perhaps, and maybe some business contracts. But he wasn't expecting this. And as he rightly says, there are no coincidences in China. This is the Chinese sending a message to the Canadians, and it's pretty loud and clear.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you about in point of fact, which is exactly how easy to read the tea leaves can be when these things happen. If therefore it is calculated to be a very specific, almost provocative gesture, one might say, what's the anticipated reaction? Is the idea that this becomes this game of tit for tat, or is there a bit of grandstanding and it's one gesture and then maybe everyone kind of hopes they can all move on? Does it sort of presage a period there then of mutual antagonism?
Well, you know, you can imagine if you're a Canadian at the moment, you know, you're used to traveling the world and everyone being quite happy to see you. You know, they're pretty friendly people. The passport's pretty good. But now, if you're a Canadian traveling to China, you must be pretty panicked about what's going to happen or living in China, because, you know, if this does escalate, what comes next? They start rounding up all the Canadians in China. For Canada, you've got to feel a bit sorry for them, because they really are caught in the middle of this. We're saying tit for tat. But the reason why Canada arrested Sabrina Meng in Vancouver was very much because the Americans asked them to. The tit for tat that's going on really is between China and the US. But in China, in all the newspapers, it really is Canada that's being attacked. You know, Canada is being attacked for being a puppet of the US, a Canadian lapdog. So they're in a bit of a bind here. They can't, you know, not really being able to roll over, because if they release, well, she's on bail, but if they give her back to China, then that will infuriate the US. So they are really caught between a rock and a hard place.
Well, and to that point, I was going to just check in with you about this more broadly. We talk a lot about, on Monocle 24, about various sort of proxy conflicts around the world. In the sort of trade and diplomacy space, the Sino-US relationship is kind of the only game in town at the moment. From your station in Hong Kong, is it one of those things where it's almost impossible to view any diplomatic engagement or political manoeuvrings without the prism of that relationship? I mean, it certainly informs this one, and it kind of informs almost all other narratives at the moment.
Yes, it's difficult to find any story at the moment that doesn't have a US-China a trade link. You know, what's interesting from an Asian or an Eastern perspective is that China has been quite reluctant to bash the US. Anyone who's tried to kind of maybe make fun of Donald Trump has been, you know, kind of told to quieten down a bit, because they know how important US trade is for on a national level. So I feel like this is Canada, in a sense, is a way for China to kind of let off some steam. You know, they can beat Canada around a bit, and I guess feel a bit better about themselves. So, you know, this, as I said, Canada's been I guess caught out a bit here. But you're right. Everything at the moment does have is seen through a US-China trade prism. And I see that continuing into 2019.
James, great to hear from you, as always. That was our James Chambers here in London. James, thanks for being with us on the Monocle Daily. Here are some other stories we're following today. Italy's Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini has been forced to deny reports in the Italian press that his ruling Lega Party is considering pushing for a snap election in March. Salvini is currently visiting Jerusalem and told the Italian news agency AGI that the government will stay on for 5 years. Japan has chosen the symbol that means disaster to define the year 2018. In the annual vote, the public nominated the kanji character after experiencing a number of natural disasters. Japan suffered flooding, typhoons, earthquakes and heat waves in the past 12 months, which have all contributed to a shrinking economy. And a Stasi ID pass used by Vladimir Putin when he was a Soviet spy in East Germany has been found in Dresden. Russia's president previously expressed pride in his record as a KGB agent. His pass was found during research into the cooperation between his organisation and the Stasi in East Germany. This is the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, the first rule of the Club of Venice is you do not talk about the Club of Venice. Or, more accurately, you don't talk about who said what at the organisation's biannual meetings, because they take place under the Chatham House rule. The club is a safe space for the top communications officials in the European Union's institutions and European governments, and it gives them a chance to exchange ideas and discuss the challenges of their very particular profession. Agenda items at the latest meeting included everything from fake news to the EU's failure to communicate why it's a good thing. Monocle's Guy Delaunay managed to talk his way in.
The communications gurus behind the governments of Europe are gathering here at Palazzo Franchetti. The Club of Venice has been going for 32 years now, and membership is highly selective, or you could say self-selecting. You need to be a senior member of the government communications team in one of the EU member states, or one of the countries applying for EU membership, or alternatively, one of the European Union institutions. And this reception is a chance for people in some of the world's most stressful jobs to relax with colleagues who understand the pressure.
Those who are basically professionals and they are involved in such important topics like communication, they felt approaching each other through an informal context was going to provide added value to what was their formal agenda.
Vincenzo Lavoci is the Secretary General of the Club of Venice.
the members, full members of the club, are director generals, directors of communication, but they also have a senior communication specialist, those who are basically in charge of European affairs in terms of spokespersons. And of course, you bring basically together a mix of expertise. We never get rid of the members of the club, even if they are changing jobs, they are moving to other countries, because the added value they bring because of the expertise, it's really what enriches the dialogue and the capacity to discuss and find possible common orientations.
So you can never leave the Club of Venice?
Not really, unless somebody says, well, I got something else to do. I mean, the club is really there for people to bring their own experience as a sort of a way to enrich the others who come.
The club meets twice a year at venues all over Europe, but one of the gatherings is always in Venice, this time right next to the Grand Canal and Ponte dell'Accademia. If you've seen one James Bond film too many, it creates an atmosphere of international intrigue, and the application of the Chatham House rule means that as far as discussions are concerned, what happens in Venice largely stays in Venice. But happily, the participants are quite open about what they've come here to discuss. Michele Landabasso is the Director of Strategic Communication at the European Commission.
This is a learning experience, which has informality to it. It's an opportunity to build for people, the right people, to talk about the right themes at the right time, to exchange good practice, to look forward, to understand the projects, the problems, and how they are being tackled all over the Union, but are still informal enough to be able to learn once again.
How much stress are people in jobs like yours under?
This particular role of being on the front line, communicating also through social media every day, real time with the citizens, and very close to the political world with all its constraints, is stressful. You don't want to make a mistake. You need to use the truth, the honest truth, and intelligent truth, and not use the tools of the dark side.
And have you felt yourself getting better, do you think, through your attendance at Club of Venice meetings?
Yes. Yes, because I've learned. Yes, because this is useful. This is real. I don't know how good I got. I know that I have to get a lot better, and this is why I keep attending.
Despite its low profile and specialist nature, the club does welcome new members. This time around, one of them is Susana Vasiljevic, the media advisor for Serbia's president.
For me, it's very important to try to understand how the way of communication works inside the EU, because this is for us very important. We need to persuade our citizens to become the part of the EU. So how do I supposed to present the idea of the EU? I think that's the best place to learn about it, or how to avoid people getting away from the idea of the EU. I think that's again the best place to learn.
What are you hoping you're going to take away from this?
I hope I will get more understanding for Serbian problem. I will get maybe more experience in how to send the messages to the Serbian audience, and I hope to get these people to my country next year.
Although there's a social side, the club can be as formal as the wood-panelled interior of Palazzo Franchetti. Over the 2 days of the meeting, the participants heard presentations about some of the most pressing communications problems before debating possible solutions. On the agenda, how to recover citizens' trust in the EU and defence against the hybrid threats from disinformation and cyber attacks. That's a topic in which Lithuania's Director of Communication, Ritas Paulauskas, has some hard-earned expertise.
We are on the sort of constant front line. We at least detect around 50,000 sort of interactive fake news or the propaganda or the disinformation activities yearly. So this is essential for us to able to really to move with our own narrative, supportive of the European ideas and ideals, and to counter the narratives which are against those.
So meetings of the Club of Venice allow all of these specialists from the different European countries and the European institutions to get together and
develop strategies in an unpressured environment?
Perhaps not the strategies, but rather good understanding and sort of listening to what exactly is going on there. Venice is, as an informal setting, allows us to play with or to discuss the certain ideas in a really safe environment with a Chatham House rule. Going back to our institutions, we have the better understanding where others stand for these issues, and then it's much easier to move.
The conviviality lasts just 2 short days, then it's back to individual challenges in home countries and Brussels. But the relations which have been forged here will endure, and the ideas developed will play a part in communication strategies across Europe in the coming years. For Monocle, in Venice, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Thank you, Guy. You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Tom Edwards. Do stay tuned. The last fortnight has seen the Spanish capital suddenly emerge as a new European leader in the fight to curb car fumes. A scheme to restrict non-residential traffic is showing why success often depends on a skillful balance between both carrot and stick. And our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, took to the pavements to breathe in the new milieu and track down those pioneering change.
On the 30th of November 2018, madrileños awoke to a rather apocalyptic forecast.
Los comerciantes, los dueños de parkings y otros colectivos que dicen esto les va a arruinar la
protesta. Chaos in the streets, the calamitous collapse of social order, a death blow to business. After years of diffidence, Madrid Central, a long gestating plan to implement permanent sweeping restrictions on intercity traffic, had finally arrived, and the usual gaggle of hysterics were going into hyperdrive. One prominent firebrand, conservative mayor of outlying town Alcorcón, went so far as to tweet pictures of the Berlin Wall, claiming communists love erecting walls and restricting people's free movement. That commie jab pointed squarely at Madrid's progressive left-leaning mayor Manuela Carmena.
Un proceso de una lucha clara, pues por tener una ciudad mejor. Y lo importante es eso.
By day's end, with the benefit of actual numbers, road congestion across Madrid Central's 472 hectares had fallen by 45%. When fully enforced, estimates say these new rules will curb vehicle emissions by 40%. Madrid has long lagged behind its European peers in environmental action, especially in tackling its nefarious smog. So how did the city suddenly pole vault into the role of pioneer? Key to it all were madrileños themselves. Just listen to a reporter's efforts on the regional broadcaster's breakfast show, jamming his mic through car windows, fishing for dissent on the newly renovated and now traffic-restricted boulevard Gran Vía.
Una pregunta, señor motorista. ¿Se nota que está en funcionamiento Madrid Central?
See if you can gauge the mood of motorists, keeping in mind a favor is positive, while en contra means opposed.
A favor o en contra de Madrid Central?
A favor.
¿Están ustedes a favor o en contra de Madrid Central?
Hombre, pues a favor, ¿no? Está bien. Pues a favor de que haya menos contaminación.
Bueno, ¿está a favor o en contra de Madrid Central?
Estoy súper a favor.
¿Y usted, señora, que tiene niños?
Súper a favor.
No. Predicar. Como que se va a...
While the opposition forecasts imminent chaos or the apocalypse, eventually time and reality will put everyone in their place. Opposition is fine, but with such a lack of rigor and with so much opportunism, they just open themselves up to ridicule.
Y con tanto oportunismo que te lleva al ridículo.
Inés Sabanés is Madrid's motivated environment and mobility councillor, and we're sitting in her wide-windowed sixth-floor office at City Hall.
Well, one thing I've noticed just sitting here in your office is that we can actually see on the horizon the little line of Madrid pollution. Is that something that encourages you every day?
Yes, I see it continuously. But keep in mind, Madrid, especially this time of year, always has a high risk of pollution, which has been a problem for many years, meaning it needs to be tackled forcefully.
De forma continua.
Sabanés has spent the last 3.5 years overseeing the ambitious environmental Plan A, cue the slogan, because there's no Plan B. which encompasses 30 different measures, from the renaturalization of the Manzanares River to more pedestrian-friendly pavements.
We had to make a great effort, a measurable effort. There may be the occasional breach of pollution protocols, but you need a clear roadmap. Namely, what has to be done tomorrow, what has to be done in 2020 and in 2030. I think what Madrid did well was simple. Cooperate with other cities, take international inspiration and listen to experts and professionals.
So what you're saying is that first you listen to what the people wanted, second you listen to experts, and third you planned long term, which is a recipe which isn't very common in politics these days.
No, pero es la única.
No, but it's the only way. The immediacy of the easy headline might deliver short-term results, but it's a grave mistake to let this approach guide a city's politics. And I'm a strong believer in politics. What happened in Madrid is a familiar story in many other cities. Cities possess a strong position of leadership when it comes to change, sometimes much more powerful than nation-states, because we have more tools at our disposal. But the main thing we need to have a clear head about, whether we like it or not, is that these challenges aren't constrained by electoral timetables.
Another key to Madrid Central's rollout has been a softly, softly approach. Motorists won't start receiving fines until several months from now, with the interim period focusing on informing rather than reprimand.
I believe it's essential to do so gradually. This fuels debate, which helps people understand the objective and where their obligation lays.
Eschewing the standard electoral myopia and championing greater cooperation between cities to share learnings, Sabanes also says that cities and city planners need to ask themselves one question.
What am I doing to fulfill my pledge? If my only focus is winning elections, we would never take the step, because there's never a convenient moment. That's what always happened in Madrid. Between preparing policy or not preparing it, the elections crept up and nothing was done. You just have to push ahead. The people will decide.
Y la gente dirá.
Back amongst the foot traffic, I stopped by the studio of street art collective Boa Mistura, who are part of a fully fledged charm offensive aimed at pedestrians.
There are 1,100 verses in the street. And we have received poems from the people and from poets.
After a bout of guerrilla art, saw them emblazon 33 poetry verses on Madrid streets back in 2014, Madrid's mayor invited Boa Mistura to expand the project as a way to encourage pedestrians to see walking as a poetic act.
How many submissions did you get?
More than 20,000. More than 20,000, yeah. We have to read all of them, select it, and then classify them.
Explain to me the idea that the city wants to make walking a poetic act. Is that just a bit of marketing, or do you think there's something to it to kind of encourage people to walk?
For us, as we did this project 4 years ago, for us it's just an artistic activity. It's an artistic intention when we do this. Of course, if we write a poem in the street, we are telling, okay, you can use the street for something else than walking and going from one point to another point.
The streets and the cities are lots of emotions because there are people that are, for example, are in love, and you got to write something for the people who are in love, but there are people who are angry or people who are excited or thinking about other things or sad, even sad. And poetry talks about emotions, not only love.
I think this project is one of the tentacles to make the city more friendly to the people, because we have to start to think the street like something else than a place to move and to drive. Is a place where everything can happen, so why not poetry?
Underwriting this overnight success story is Madrileños' underestimated civic pride. Proving they favour less cars and cleaner air, the national Spanish government is now proposing to ban high-emission vehicles in 138 Spanish urban areas by 2025. After all the theatrical huff and puff, down here on the ground, the simple promise of clean air is being inhaled with a collective breath of enthusiasm. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
Monocle's Liam Aldous there. Tune in to The Urbanist tomorrow at 1900 London time, right here on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Monocle Daily.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Time now for a check on some of the most interesting stories from all across Asia. We're joined today by Simona Vittorini, Senior Teaching Fellow in the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS here in London, but now here in the studio. Simona, good to have you with us this evening. Let's start with a really interesting look at the state elections results. We're looking to India, of course, the Hindustan Times. Tell us a little bit more about this one.
Yes, this has been quite an astonishing result from the state elections. These were the five last state elections in India before the national elections in May 2019. The results looks like to have been a setback for the BJP, the Narendra Modi's party. In fact, it had lost the majority in the three largest states. And this is the first time that this has happened since Narendra Modi was elected in 2014. Equally interesting is the fact that the Congress, which has been decimated in 2014, the Indian National Congress, seems to have gained more seats and has won some of the states. So this has been particularly interesting.
And I wonder, it's often interesting when we look at regional or state elections to people often quick to say, well, you know, this is a bellwether for the big picture. But I guess here that is quite instructive. And I wonder, does the coverage of this story suggest that, you know, people are reading in this could be a more significant setback even further down the road potentially?
Yeah, absolutely. It is, in fact, read that way, especially when state elections are held so close to the general elections and the national elections. Especially also these states in particular have got this trend, and analysts have suggested that they are the bellwether for the national elections. It is also, these results might be also an indication for the party in power, Bharatiya Janata Party, Narendra Modi's party, in how to run elections. It seems that the electoral plank of development, job creation has been abandoned this time in favor of more Hindu religious agenda. In fact, the star campaigner, this turn was not Narendra Modi, but the UP, the Uttar Pradesh Chief Minister Aditya Nand, who is a hardcore Hindu nationalist supporter. He's a priest himself, a Hindu priest. And he has talked more in the campaign about, you know, temples, about religion rather than development, jobs.
And I guess, you know, we know there's a truism about elections. It's the economy, stupid, all of this
thing. Absolutely,
we should probably expect to see that pivot and that change of emphasis as we head on into 2019, presumably.
I think so, because some of the, what is in the what is coming up from these results at the moment is that there was a lot of dissatisfaction from the electorate vis-a-vis the economy. The demonetization of 2 years ago had impacted severely, especially those who depend or work in the informal sector, so, you know, self-employed businessmen, let's say, but also the job creation that was promised has not materialized. The rupees is sliding down, and it is expected, in fact, that between now and May 2019, when the general elections will be held, it is expected that Narendra Modi will launch some populist policies to, you know, meet these demands.
As ever in the months preceding,
as ever,
preceding
yes.
general elections, wherever in the world we look.
Yeah.
Story two, which we'll look at now from the Economic Times, an appointment of Shaktikanta Das. Tell us a little bit about the role and why this is interesting?
This is interesting because of the ways in which the appointment of the new Reserve Bank of India governor has happened. The previous RBI governor resigned suddenly last Monday, Urjit Patel. He resigned citing personal issues, but there has been a lot of tensions in the past few years between the RBI, the Reserve Bank of India, and the government, Narendra Modi's government. Especially recently, these tensions have escalated anywhere about the releasing of more liquidity in the banking sector, especially in the run up to these general elections coming up. So the elections are still coming up very strongly in many of the news in India at the moment. The appointment of Das is significant, not just because it suggests a centralization of power in the hands of the prime minister, you know, this change in at the head of RBIs, but also because Das was the man, the face of the demonetization campaign. So either the demonetization was not that successful. In fact, as I mentioned before, it had impacted severely the economy of India. And some data is indicating that India's economy is slowing down. It has registered growth lower than 80% than it was expected this last quarter. So it's quite puzzling as to why Das has been selected as the next governor.
Interesting. And questions about the autonomy of various reserve banks, wherever you look, and particularly in India, that narrative, again, sure to crop back up, certainly on the campaign trail and into 2019.
Yeah.
Let's shift our focus a little, Simona, and look to a story that I think has appeared in the Hindu. This is, of course, about in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting one. This is about, well, I don't know, this is a good old-fashioned, turbulent political story, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a saga that has been going on for 2 months almost. So it all started in October when the president of Sri Lanka, Sirisena, dismissed its prime minister, Vikramasinghe, and substituted him, or actually sworn in, Mahinda Rajapaksa, the previous president, controversial previous president of Sri Lanka, as the new prime minister. This change the Supreme Court is expected to rule as to the inconstitutionality of this act. But since then, since October and now, there have been at least 3 votes of confidence. The parliament has expressed its confidence to Vikramasinghe, so the elected prime minister, already 3 times, once today itself. And yet, Sirisena is not changing his mind. Rajapaksa still continues to believe to be the prime minister, has elected as a new cabinet. So at the moment in Sri Lanka, there are 2 prime ministers, 2 cabinets, and a standoff. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on the inconstitutionality of the dismissal this week. Sirisena had also asked for a new round of elections, so he had dismissed the parliament once the parliament didn't support Rajapaksa, but all this is suspended for the moment.
Seems kind of chaotic. I think one thing, even in this country, we definitely wouldn't want 2 prime ministers and 2 governments.
No,
that would definitely be a case of too many cooks. I just wonder, you have a story like this, which is obviously, it's great for kind of political watchers. Is this the sort of thing that potentially threatens to be more destabilising for, you know, for the country as a whole? It's presumably, it's far from a good thing.
Yes, it is. It is very problematic. It has a huge potential for destabilisation, politically for sure, but also on the economic point of view, because Sri Lanka is expected to vote for its next budget. Pass his next budget, 2019 budget. But if the parliament is dismissed, the budget won't be voted. I mean, the parliament is dismissed at the moment. So we are waiting for the Supreme Court ruling. So if the Supreme Court ruling against this dismissal, then the budget hopefully will be passed. But if not, then there will be a government shutdown.
And the crisis could be set fair to continue. Let's talk about another. You're mentioning this court ruling we expect in mid-January related in Sri Lanka. UK court ruling, another story. This is interesting. The Vijay Mallya extradition. Just remind us about the background of this one.
Vijay Mallya is a businessman. He was called the Richard Branson of India, a very flamboyant businessman. He was the owner of Kingfisher Beer, Kingfisher Airlines. he also expanded his business into branching his business into Formula One racing at one point, and then everything came tumbling down in 2012. He had piled up huge debts, and then he left the country after accusation of fraud and money laundering, etc. The Indian government has been going after Vijay Mallya for quite some time. Vijay Mallya has argued that these court rulings and the whole court proceedings were politically motivated. Mm. Narendra Modi has been trying to present himself as a corruption fighter, especially presenting an image of a clean man, a clean government, against the previous Congress governments, etc. So there is some truth in that, in the sense that bringing back Vijay Mallya, yesterday's court ruling that has said that there's no evidence of political motivation behind this case, is a victory for India in one sense, and might be like a cap in the feather for Narendra Modi if they manage to bring back Vijay Mallya.
If they do. I guess that's the big unanswered question.
There is now the case is going to the UK Home Minister. And then after that, Vijay Mallya and his legal team will have the right to appeal. So nothing is expected between 12 to 18 months.
So don't hold your breath just yet. Simona, great to speak with you. Thanks for guiding us through a great selection of stories. That's Simona Vitorini from SOAS joining us here on The Monocle Daily. We end with a peek at Monocle's weekly newspaper, The Winter Weekly, which is on shelves now at all good newsstands. Our business editor, Venetia Rainey, is here to go through some of the top headlines. Hello, Venetia. Welcome to the programme. Good to have you with us. Now, The Winter Weekly business story, is there a kind of an overarching editorial approach to the business section? I guess it's just, as we always do at Monocle, great stories, right? Is that the idea?
Great stories, exactly, Tom. Great stories and... With all the winter weekly papers, we've been turning to the colder climes. So we started off this business section with a story from Nozawa Onsen in Japan, which is an amazing ski resort that's really tried to buck the trend of ski resorts that bring in these huge international hotel chains and have chain restaurants and all of this stuff. Nozawa Onsen hasn't done any of that. And despite the ski industry declining in general in Japan, stuff's going really well for these guys. So it proves that it works. That's the kind of story we love. And so they've got these small independent ryokans and small independent business owners who are trying to find new ways to cook with local ingredients. And they've got a guy who's shepherding the development of the resort who really cares about preserving the village's best interests rather than just making lots of money. So that's a really interesting story. And we sort of, you know, go down the slopes and meet some of the people who are in the village and are making that all work.
I can almost sort of feel the snowflakes falling onto my head. That's the dream assignment. Is that one of those ones where you're like, hang on, I'm the business editor, I've got this one? Or was it one of our lucky colleagues in our Asia Bureau who was dispatched?
It was one of our lucky colleagues in Japan who got to do that.
A few days in the onsen, hit the slopes, little après-ski. I'm sure they're very professional at all times, of course.
Sadly, when he was reporting, the snow hadn't quite come yet. And that's been an issue that ski resorts are facing in Japan, that the snow is coming later and later. But if you do a resort well and you've got other attractions, for example, Nozawa Onsen is an onsen town, that's in the name. So they have a lot of hot springs where you can cook vegetables and, you know, bathe, obviously.
And also, you don't need to ski to enjoy après-ski,
well,
as I understand it.
Definitely true.
In fact, some people just do the après, none of the skiing, which they're very welcome to. Let's talk about slush. Now, it's not the Weather Channel. Remind us what this is, and there's a bit of coverage of this, which is an intriguing story, again, in the Winter Weekly business pages.
Yes, and also a radio report somewhere on Monocle 24.
You're not wrong, Venetia. We had plenty of coverage across our news programming over the last few days, in fact. Our intrepid Daniel Bache, headed for Helsinki, which is where the Slush Festival takes place. But as I said again, this is not about liquid forms of snow. It's a sort of big old tech, one of the biggest sort of tech get-togethers around.
It is, and it's basically a music festival for tech startups. They go there, they have a bit of a sauna and steam, this is Finland after all, and they meet investors, or if they're an investor, they meet promising startups. And the idea is really to get people together in the room and create some business for these people. Finland has a really promising startup scene, and they're trying to push the boundaries a bit as well. So one of the things Daniel was looking at is the way that they're trying to include gender diversity in the sort of startup scene, which is a bit of a problem. You know, coding and those sorts of jobs seen as very typically male and still attract very male candidates. So it's a really interesting event, and it sounds like a lot of fun. I was actually quite jealous that Daniel went.
Now, talking to a profession that does it, sadly, is quite sort of gender, there are quite a few gender barriers. Santa, he's a guy, he's Finnish as well. Santa's working life in sharp focus on the pages.
We really tried to take a business look at what it's like.
It's a big business. It's a big business. Father Christmas is a big business. Father Christmas PLC.
I mean, look, you can't do it all year round. So, but we spoke to a guy who works for the Ministry of Defence, a civil servant, a veteran civil servant, a serious guy who switches his black suit for a red suit every single year and has actually been awarded an OBE for his services to the community. I'm not sure how much money he makes, but it is a real job. You know, he has to manage clients' expectations. He has to handle the logistics. He's thinking about where the reindeer are coming from and where they should be going to next, and you know, is his outfit in fit condition, and how does he communicate with his customers, which are children sitting on his lap asking for a toy train set, and the parents who want to manage those expectations.
That's very important.
Very important.
I speak from experience.
So, you know, it's a real job, and we wanted to take a light-hearted but serious look at that.
That could be the subheader of the Monocle Winter Weekly. Benicia, some of this, it certainly could drive an editor to drink. Graf Brewery maybe serves up a few tipples that might work for you yourself?
Absolutely. I'm certainly going to be looking into where I can get some of these beers. They come from Tromsø, which is in furthest, deepest, darkest Norway. They brew Christmas beers, this Graf Brewery, which is a big business in Norway, I hear. They were originally made to pray to the gods that they would bring the sun back. So when you live in Tromsø, the sun just sets for several months and just doesn't come up. So you need beer to help you through that kind of thing, frankly. They brew some really interesting beers out of a lovely little brewery there. Another great assignment.
Well, I was going to say, who was dispatched to do, who was the lucky correspondent that was drawn out of the hat for that one?
We used Debbie Papin, who reported a really lovely story for us.
And as I'm sure, 100% professional and sober at all times.
100% professional.
But you need to try.
No beer past her lips.
You need to. Oh, really? But you surely need to try just to get a sense of, have they truly captured the flavour of the holiday period? I mean,
maybe she doesn't even like beer. I actually didn't ask. She's a good writer. That's all I know.
There you go. See, we only work with the very, very finest journalists from all around the world, or in this place, often in Northern Europe, or where there's a dusting of snow at this time of year.
Exactly.
Lovely stuff. Venetia, great to speak with you as always. That was our Venetia Rainey, Monocle's business editor and responsible for the B pages of our lovely Winter Weekly, which you can still get hold of right now at all good newsstands. That's it for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. The programme was produced by Daniel Bache and Tom Hall. The researchers were Daphne Karnazes, Martha Libri and Nick Manise. Our studio manager was David Stevens. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time, Ben Rylan in the chair, and this programme, The Monocle Daily, is back at the same time tomorrow. To end the show, a little touch of extra seasonality for you from your friends at The Monocle Daily. Here's the one and only Nat King Cole with some chestnuts roasting on an open fire. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.
Anyways, Merry Christmas to you.